Good afternoon, everyone, and good morning to those of you watching online and who are not in the Eastern time zone. My name is Jeff Singer. I'm a practicing surgeon and a senior fellow here at the Cato Institute. Last month, the Association of American Medical Colleges released an updated report on physician supply and demand projections through 2036. The study used, quote, multiple supply and demand scenarios and was, quote, updated with the latest information on trends in healthcare delivery and the state of the healthcare workforce, such as data on physician work hours and retirement trends. The AAMC projects that by 2036, there'll be a shortage of up to 86,000 physicians, including 40,000 primary care physicians. About 20% of physicians are over age 65, with an additional 22% of the workforce between age 55 and 64. As these doctors reach retirement age over the next decade, this may further impact physician supply. Areas that are presently underserved by healthcare practitioners will likely feel this more acutely. According to the National Association of Community Health Centers, 30% of Americans don't have a primary care doctor, and the average wait time for a first-time appointment with a primary care practitioner is 26 days. The average wait time for a first-time OBGYN appointment is 31 days. The Health Resources and Services Administration claims, as of December 2022, that more than 98 million people lived in what it designates as health professional shortage areas, or areas with only enough primary care providers to meet just 47.3% of the population's medical needs. Many experienced and international medical graduates, or IMGs as we call them, doctors who receive their training and are licensed and practicing in other countries, would like to come to the United States and provide healthcare services to Americans. They could reduce the growing healthcare access bottleneck. However, unlike Canada, Australia, the European Union countries, and many other developed countries, states require such doctors to repeat their entire residency training in an accredited residency program in the US, even if they've been practicing for years in their home countries, and pass the standardized US Medical Licensing Exam, or USMLE. Such demanding requirements cause many experienced physicians who can't get a spot in a residency program or can't afford to repeat the education and training they already received to find work in other fields. It also increases the number of medical school graduates competing for residency positions at a time when there are already not enough positions available for every graduate. Roughly 8% of medical school graduates are unable to land a position in a residency program at match time each year. In 2023, Tennessee became the first state to grant provisional licenses to experienced IMGs who obtained a position with a medical practice after 2 years under supervision in that practice and after completing all three steps of the USMLE. These doctors' licenses become unrestricted, allowing them to practice anywhere within the state. The law takes effect in 2025. This year, governors in several other states, including Florida, Virginia, and Idaho, have signed similar reform bills into law. While not a panacea, such reforms can help improve access to healthcare and take advantage of the talent and expertise that many immigrant physicians have to offer us. However, this reform is not without its critics. Joining us to discuss this reform are Jonathan Wolfson to my left. He's Chief Legal Officer and Policy Director of the Cicero Institute. The Cicero Institute has been working to reform licensing laws to make it easier for IMGs to obtain licenses in the United States. And Jonathan could provide us with a status report on those efforts across the country. To his left is Makbul Halapota, MD, FACP. He's the medical director of Palo Verde Oncology in Scottsdale, Arizona. I work with him. He's an immigrant from Pakistan, where he trained as a physiatrist. For those of you who don't know what that is, a rehab medicine specialist, rehabilitating stroke and spinal cord injury patients and limb amputees. He also taught medical students at his alma mater in Pakistan. And at the end is, but last but not least, is Lisa A. Robin, Chief Advocacy Officer for the Federation of State Medical Boards, which represents the interests of the medical licensing boards across the United States. Lisa can share with us the medical board's perspectives on this and similar reforms within the US. After we hear from each of our distinguished panelists, I'll lead a discussion, and then we'd like to hear from our audience, both in the auditorium and those watching online. For those watching online, you can enter questions on the event webpage, as well as on YouTube. Facebook and X using the hashtag Cato Health. Mac, we call you Mac in Arizona. Mac, I'd like to start with you. You're the only one of us on the panel who is an IMG and went through the lengthy process of becoming licensed to help help patients in Arizona. So in the process, you went from being a specialist in physiatry to being a medical oncologist. So that's an interesting story. I wonder if you could share that all with us.
Thank you, Jeff. I really appreciate that. It kind of feels awkward sitting here talking about myself, but I'm not going to talk about myself. What I'm going to try to share with you is a very typical life journey of the majority of the international medical graduates that come to this country. So bear with me as I share my story. I was, as Jeff alluded to it, I was born in Pakistan. I was born in a small town called Tundu Alayar. Tundu Alayar is a rural town in the province of Sindh. And those who are not familiar with Pakistan, Sindh is the southernmost province of Pakistan. And the word Sindh actually comes from what is most more commonly known in the Western world as the Indus Valley, because the word Indus is a derivative of the word Sindh, and the word comes from the river Indus. So it's an agrarian area, probably the breadbasket of the old world, because Indus Valley civilization ranges back about 5,000 years old. So anyway, I grew up in an upper middle class family, maybe middle class family. My father was a surgeon. Three of my elder brothers were physicians. I'm the youngest of eight brothers. Just to give you guys some perspective of where I come from. So Pakistan is an old British colony. So the medical education there is designed according to the old British style of education. And most people, most physicians, once they graduate from medical school, their destination is generally was historically to go to England to get further training and specialize. So when I graduated, because two of the three brothers who are physicians were already in England. One of them is a general practitioner, other is a psychiatrist, and that was going to be my goal. I was going to go to England. My father, being a surgeon, wanted all his sons to become surgeons. None of my elder brothers chose surgery, so I was under pressure to become a surgeon. That's not what I wanted to do. But in those days, we didn't really have a lot of choice. Our parents kind of chose for us what you wanted to do. But his dream was that I should go to England and be trained as a surgeon. That's what I was going to do. But one of my brothers, the general practitioner in England, told me that the future of medicine is not in England, it's in the US. You should try to go to the US. And this was in the late 80s, early 90s. And as life would take us, sometimes it's what we want in life, and sometimes the circumstances will direct you in certain directions. So this was the time when that there was a famous case in the U.S. and there was a decision by one of the courts that the working hours for residents should be limited. And suddenly there was a huge opening of a lot of residency slots, because previously the residency programs were trying to get a few residents to do most of their work, but after that they had to hire a lot of new residents into their training programs. And I was doing physical medicine in Pakistan, listening to my brother's advisor, and suddenly there was all these openings. There was the three or four of us guys who had gone to school together. We decided to come to the U.S. and we landed in Coney Island. We rented an apartment, and I don't know how many of you are familiar with Coney Island, a part of Brooklyn. This was a very old, typical, mostly Jewish neighborhood, and where there's three guys from Pakistan living there. So that was a cultural shock. But one thing that it taught me was that, no matter who we are, at the end of it, we're all human beings. And the love and the care that we received by our neighbors, as they tried to help us get on our feet. there, you know, we started looking for residency slots. I was primarily looking for physical medicine and rehab. But one of the things that had happened is that because of these new slots, there were a lot of new slots in the specialties that required inpatient care, like surgery, medicine, but physical medicine did not have a lot of new slots, and I was having a hard time getting into, you know, into physical medicine and rehab. And then the other requirement to get into physical medicine rehab was that you needed at least a year of transitional year, our internal medicine here. So I started applying for internal medicine slots. I got into internal medicine. And I think a couple of things happened. First of all, you know, practicing in Pakistan, when you read a lot of things in your textbooks, but you don't have the technology to be able to apply them on a day-to-day basis. And then you come here, and all of those things that you had read as probable fiction in, you know, in textbooks was something that was now available to you, and you could apply it. So the internal medicine, the way you practice here, was much more exciting. So that was one of the things. And I decided to stay in internal medicine. And then I did my internship in a hospital called the Methodist Hospital in Brooklyn. Then I got a opening in the University of Kentucky, so I decided to complete my internal medicine, you know, residency for 3 years. At that point, I was on a J-1 visa, you know, and so in order to get my green card, I'd get the J-1 visa waived, I was started looking for positions, and Kentucky has a lot of underserved counties. So I was offered a job in a small town called Berea, Kentucky, and I don't know how many, again, if you are familiar with Berea. I'm just trying to share the variety of experiences that I've had, which is probably true for most human lives, but I think my experiences have been a little more, you know, varied. But anyway, so I ended up in Berea, which was another, I think, a great experience. And this so happened that, you know, again, the other thing that happened that during that time, my four-year-old niece got diagnosed with acute lymphoblastic leukemia, and she was being treated at St. Jude's Hospital. And some of my most favorite professors and teachers that I connected with the most were also oncologists, people who have shaped my life and who I am right now. So it just so. And also, the other thing that happened was that while I was doing my waiver in Berea, one of the fellows in Hemonc decided to leave early because he just wanted to do 2 years and just be certified in one board, not both the hematology oncology board, just one oncology. So all of these things kind of fell in place. So I ended up being an oncologist. Now, looking back at it, this is what I was destined to do. You know, we talk about what is destiny and how much is this all existential and we control everything that happens? Is it predetermined? I don't know. I don't think I'll know in my lifetime at least. But so what I started with was my father wanted me to be a surgeon. I wanted to be a physical medicine and rehab doctor. I ended up being a medical oncologist. But in doing that, this is probably what was destined for me, and I think this is the best that could have happened to me. But in the meantime, what happened was that I think I had to take a few detours, and if I look back at my life, I think it shaved at least a decade, maybe half a decade of my life, because when I was doing physical medicine and rehab, and I decided, okay, I'm going to now pursue going to the United States, I had to take my USMLE. And as you all are familiar, USMLE consists of a part one, which is basic sciences, and then there's a part two, which is the clinical, you know, skills. So now, because I'd already, you know, and in medical schools, both here and in Pakistan, they teach you the basic sciences in the first 2 or 3 years, and then the rest of the time you spend learning, not only learning the clinical knowledge, but acquiring the clinical skills, as Dr. Singer would know, that, you know, as a physician, you have your theoretic base, but the skills that you acquire you cannot get it from textbooks. You get it from people you work with, from your teachers, from your, you know, from your peers. But anyway, so when I was doing physical medicine and I decided to take USMLE, I had to actually go back and I got a job as they call it a demonstrator, a lecturer in my alma mater to teach anatomy. Actually, I was teaching, histology, so that I could brush up on my basic sciences to be able to take my part one. And so then you have to go back, and then now you go from, you know, being in a clinical setting to going back and reacquiring your, refreshing your basic sciences. And then you have to go back and take your part two to reacquire your clinical, you know, sciences. So that takes a little time. And then you come here and you go through, you know, your either the same specialty that you were trained, are you completely go into a totally different specialty. So the 4 years that you had acquired your skills, you know, overseas, those are completely, they're never lost. Even as a medical oncologist, when my patients are in chemotherapy, I still believe that I do, they do benefit from my experience as a physical medicine and rehab doctor, because when you're treating people with cancer, you are trying to rehab them also at the same time. So, but still, those 4 or 5 years of training that you did, that's lost. And then that, you know, then when you have to go back to take your, refresh your basics, that's a few more years. And then you come here and you have to go through the waiver, and that's another 3 or 4 years. So when you accumulate all that, for each physician, if you'd say on the average, they lose 5 or 10 years of their, experience, or their productive, the most productive years of their professional life. Now you multiply that with the thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of, you know, physicians who come here. There is, I don't think you can quantify the amount of time and professional skills that is lost that could otherwise be avoided if the process was more streamlined. So I think I hope I don't have too much time left, or I have not taken too much time. No, so that's my story.
Well, we'll come back to some more of this later, but I want to go now to John. So John, you've been working on this reform project for a few years now with the Cicero Institute, and you probably know as much about it as anybody about what legislative efforts are underway around the country and their status. So if you could tell us all about why Cicero got involved with this and what's the state of affairs.
Yeah, so thanks so much, Jeff, and to Cato Institute for hosting me today. This has been a project I've gotten to work on for the last 3 years here at the Cicero Institute. There are a number of other organizations around the country. I'll give a shout out to World Education Services, my friend Mike Zimmer, who also does a lot of work on this issue. We've gotten to partner with a number of the states that we're going to talk about here today. And this issue, you know, as doctor was just talking, is how do you deal with helping these doctors who want to practice here to find a way to do so? And, you know, unfortunately, there are a lot of fascinating stories. I'll just share two real quickly. Dr. Arava is one of the world's leading orthopedists. He does all the Olympic athletes' knees. He did David Beckham's knee. He does all the skiers. But if the U.S. ski team wanted to bring him to Salt Lake City, Utah, to be the U.S. ski team doctor in Utah, he wouldn't be able to get a license because he didn't do a residency in the United States. Dr. Witkowski is a U.S. citizen. He grew up here as a little kid, and then his family moved overseas. He lived overseas, planned to stay overseas, so he went to medical school, residency, did a PhD all overseas. He's a dermatologist. He has the record of dermatologists of finding the smallest melanoma, and so he's a really good doctor, and he's now on faculty at Oregon State. But he can't get licensed other than with some special licenses that work as an academic in the United States because he didn't do residency here. He's a U.S. citizen, so there's no immigration questions. He, you know, obviously speaks English. He grew up here. So none of the challenges that you would think that an individual might have in order to practice here exist with those doctors. And that's not to say that there's not doctors around the world who the United States medical boards would want to prevent from coming. And the medical boards play a really key role. But in the United States, one of the interesting things is that you have hundreds of thousands of folks here and around the world who'd like to come here, who have very similar education to what we require to become a medical doctor. know how to speak English or know how to, in some cases, speak the language of the population they would want to work with. So for example, you have Ukrainian refugees who are here right now who may not have great English skills, but if they're living in a community of Ukrainian refugees, they probably know how to speak Ukrainian and can work with those patients. Southern California, Arizona, you've got lots of Spanish-speaking populations. If you bring doctors from Mexico who speak Spanish, the patients that they're working with, they may have those skills. They can, in many cases, have or could pass the exams that we require, and a lot of them have years and years of experience. But the thing that they don't have is a United States or Canada-based residency. And so what we require of those people is to retake that residency, repeat that training in order to get a license in the United States. Let's see if it'll go. If not, we'll just jump around. So this is a challenge that we face in, there it is. So real quickly, what we're gonna cover in these next 10 minutes, very briefly, is kind of what are the current rules, which is really that a non-US residency is not an unacceptable credential. US-based or Canada-based residency is non-negotiable. Secondly, what reforms we've been working on, and again, we've worked with lots of people. This isn't really a Cicero thing that we're doing by ourselves. There's lots of great organizations that are working on this. We've had the privilege of working with a lot of folks who've been able to advance this legislation. And then looking at the success we've had and try to look at what the outlook is for the future. It's important to recognize, as Doctor just mentioned, that international training has long been recognized in the United States. We allow people to go to medical school anywhere in the world and come do residency and get licensed in the United States. In fact, about 25% of practicing doctors in the United States went to medical school outside the United States. This includes kids who grew up in America who may have family abroad and they decide to go overseas for medical school and come back. We had some friends growing up who were from southern India and they would go back, live with their grandparents and do medical school there instead of doing college and medical school in the United States. They're all practicing medicine here in the United States now. Interestingly, the data are that these doctors trained outside the United States are more likely to be in primary care, more likely to work in underserved areas, and they generally, when the data are done, and I get that there's a lot of complications in looking at outcome data, but the outcome data or patient satisfaction data has found that internationally trained doctors have same or better outcomes for their patients. And so this isn't a question of whether these individuals have the skill. Now, I'll caveat all this and admit that we get to cream skim when we do bring people in on residencies, right? The United States has that privilege. So some of these data might be skewed in that way. And so I'm not saying that every doctor trained around the world is better than every doctor trained in the United States. That's not true. But when the United States gets to do our process of bringing people in for residencies, we're able to bring in some of the best and brightest from around the world. Interestingly, the data are that in a lot of cases, they have similar or superior academics as well. And that even while they're here, they end up producing more research as a result of their practices. But as I said, residency is the non-negotiable. So if you go to medical school in the United States, if you go to medical school outside the United States, you have to do a United States or Canada-based residency. Part of the problem is that in 1996, there was a freeze on Medicare graduate medical education funding, or GME funding. And I think that there are a lot of challenges, and this is not the, I'll say this now, we'll say it again in Q&A. International physician licensing does not solve the physician shortage. Dr. Singer mentioned the numbers. Those numbers, there's huge questions about how big those numbers are. One thing that we don't know, and we were talking about this earlier, is one challenge is a lot of data look at the total number of doctors, but they don't look at the number of hours those doctors are practicing. And so if a doctor is keeping her license, but is currently taking time off or is cutting her hours because she and her husband just had children, and in many cases, you have two doctors married to each other, they might have both cut their hours to spend more time with their children, all the data on total number of doctors doesn't reflect the fact that those doctors are spending maybe 20, 25 hours a week with patients instead of 40, 50, or 60 like they may have been doing in the past. Unfortunately, by capping the medical the residency funding, which was predicated on the concern that we were going to have too many doctors in the United States, imagine that, we ultimately not only locked in the total number, but they locked the locations. So now we have graduate medical education concentrated in the northeastern United States, where population was larger in the 90s, but as population has moved south and west in the United States, we've not added additional residency slots in those places. And so that creates a lot of mismatch problems. And as Jeff mentioned, one of the challenges is every year we have this match where graduating kids come out of med school, whether it's a DO program or an MD program, and they're not able to match into a residency program. We're opening new medical schools in the United States, but we're not adding residency slots. There were 200 added per year for a five-year period. But when you're talking about 80,000, some of the data say 120,000, that same report says if everybody was getting treatment at the level that we typically want in kind of suburban areas, we are short over 200,000 doctors over the next 10 years. These numbers are really big. And even if you were to find ways to say, hey, we're going to do 200 additional slots a year, that's just a drop in the bucket. So our reform proposal has been really allowing these internationally licensed doctors to get licensed in the United States without repeating that residency. That's really the only thing that we have focused on in our reform proposal. We haven't focused on trying to change USMLE requirements. We haven't focused on the immigration question at the federal level. It's been a state level because state licensing boards are the ones who decide who can and cannot practice in their states. So there are really three main prongs to our proposal. There's a lot of intricate details. Happy to talk about all of them, but the three main ones are that you have to have sponsorship by some sort of licensed healthcare provider in a state. Who that is, we can discuss. Second is that you spend 3 years in a provisional state where you're working with that sponsoring entity and you are employed by them during that period of time. And then the final is that that license automatically converts from provisional to a full license after 3 years. We, Cicero, don't like a world where that doctor has the opportunity to apply to get fully licensed, because if there are people who are upset with the whole program, there can be hurdles that are thrown in the way. That doesn't take away the power of the boards to keep bad doctors or doctors who are creating problems out of the practice, but it does allow that path to be made more smooth. We talk about similar and equivalent training, and I can go into more detail, but we want doctors who have completed a Education Commission on Foreign Medical Graduate Certification, the same as you would have to do if you were a doctor practicing outside the United States or just came out of a med school, in order to come to a US-based residency. We say you have to have that certification. We think that you have to have completed residency or some sort of practice for a number of years in the foreign country. There's some countries that don't require any residency, and so we don't want to bar those people from coming. In addition, we think after that residency, you should have 5+ years of practice in your country and then pass the USMLE and have English language proficiency. I get that, as I mentioned, there are some situations where that proficiency isn't necessary. But again, it's a reasonable model to have. And if you want to give medical boards special exceptions to say, hey, you're going to work with a specific population, maybe you would have an exception to that. One other thing that we think is important, and this is not like a non-negotiable, but I think it's important for people to think about when they're working on this. A lot of individuals who come to the United States to practice medicine have to take a little time to be here before they're able to get a residency or before they're able to practice. If you're a refugee, the data are that it takes people a year or two usually to get from their bad place to the United States, get settled enough to where they would be able to even start applying. The problem being that in certain cases, if you haven't practiced medicine in your country, your license may have lapsed. And so having some sort of look back period that says, hey, have you practiced medicine? Has your license been in good standing in your country within a particular period of time is important. And this has lots of checks and balances that allow the medical board, the insurance companies, the providers, all of those people to be involved in the process and make sure that these doctors are quality. What we think this does is ultimately open doors of opportunity for doctors from around the world who would like to come and practice in the United States, whether they are orthopedists who work on the ski team's knees, or whether they are a doctor in a foreign country whose kid is coming to the United States for college and they would prefer to come and live here. Even if it was a short period of time, those doctors can, in fact, provide services to the American population. So as Dr. Singer mentioned, in last year, Tennessee passed HB 1312, which was kind of the first full pathway passed. There have been a few states that have done some things before, and we're researching some of that. There's not been a lot of research done on what they did in Alaska and Montana back in a while ago. But recently, and they require a two-year provisional license, that the facility has to have some sort of accredited residency program on site. It doesn't have to be in the specialty the doctor is. So you could have a Banner Health facility with an orthopedist residency, and they could bring in an oncology doc to be a provisional licensee. And they have a shorter look back. You have to practice 3 out of the last 5 years. I'm going to put this map up on the screen, and this is a map of states that have been working on this issue around the country. I will caveat that there are really two of these states that we probably should change the coloring. Iowa, because Governor Reynolds yesterday signed that bill, so that is for sure. Maine, that bill has been signed, but there's a weird process in Maine where they have to go back through an appropriations process. No other state has put an appropriation on the books. And so we're talking to the folks in Maine about whether or not, if that appropriation fails, whether the licensing pathway piece of the bill does in fact still become the law. So we are assuming both of those count. We're at a place where we have 7 states that have a clear pathway to full licensure on the books, and then 2 states, Illinois and Colorado, which have mandated by their legislature to their medical boards to create pathways, which are in process of being created. And there are a number of other states that still have bills pending as we sit here right now. There are variations in this legislation around the country. The number of years of practice a doctor has to have has varied by state. The look-back period, as we've talked about, whether you have automatic conversion or whether you simply have the right to apply to the medical board. So Virginia's law basically says every 2 years you have a right to come back to the medical board and apply for the next phase of licensing. And I'll jump to the bottom middle, the sponsor, the rural practice, and then part, that's because in Virginia, they require after your first 2 years of provisional licensing, that the next 2 years have to be spent in some underserved area in the Commonwealth of Virginia. And so at each stage along the process, you have to come back to the medical board and tell them what you were up to. Who the sponsoring entity has varied by state and what sort of follow-up the sponsor has to have. In Wisconsin, the sponsor has to explicitly say, we think that this person is qualified to be a medical practitioner. There are some alternative policies that are floating around out in the world about the IMG situation. There's residency parity. So Alabama last year passed a law. They had required that doctors trained outside the United States had to have at least 2 years of residency in order to get licensed, but doctors trained in the United States only had to have 1. They've brought that down, and so they call that residency parity. There's academic practice licenses. Some states have really broad authority. North Carolina's, for example, is really broad. In North Carolina, if you are a part of the faculty at a at an academic medical center, even if your faculty job is entirely spent supervising a handful of students on rotation, you can practice in the state. So you could have University of North Carolina Hospital in Chapel Hill. They could hire doctors to be at a clinic in Asheville who are clearly not going up to Chapel Hill to teach on a regular basis. Those folks can have 99% of their practice be doing medical practice on patients and then a small portion be supervising their trainees. There are some country-specific programs that states like California have where they allow 30 doctors a year from Mexico to come and practice in the United States. There's some transition assistance programs that states like Minnesota have put on the books, and these are older programs which allow for money to be spent to help these doctors transition to a new lifestyle in the United States, because one of the big barriers for a lot of international healthcare workers in general is that simple things that we take for granted, like how do you go get groceries, how do you sign up for car insurance, they need some help doing those things in order to make it so they can focus on their career. And then the other thing, and as I mentioned, we are not opposed to doing this at the federal level, is funding, and at the state level, is funding additional residency slots, and that's definitely a need. So that's all I have. I'm really looking forward to the discussion, but I think that this is an important reform that states need to be considering. I think that as the wave is growing, states need to start looking at this as a competitive issue, because at the end of the day, there are going to be doctors from around the world who already are here, but who want to potentially come here, who are going to be looking at the options across those various states and going to decide what the best state for them is, based not only on do they prefer to live in mountains or near the ocean, but on the clearest pathway that they have to becoming fully licensed. So thank you.
Thank you. I'd like to say on for the record that I have a problem with more federal funding of residency programs, but we're not talking about that today. So, Lisa, I'd like to hear from the FSMB represents all the licensing boards of the United States. So I'd like to hear, this can't be so perfect. Some licensing boards must have issues, some maybe not so much. So fill us in on all this, please.
Sure. Happy to be here today. And I will start out by apologizing. My voice is kind of going in and out. The Federation is, as I think Dr. Singer introduced us, we are the organization of the 70 state medical and osteopathic boards in the country, D.C. and the territories. We've been around a long time, since 1912. And really, we are there to, we provide a number of services. And as far as our discussion today, we do a lot of policy work. And really, that policy work is by consensus. From each state board has a say in what gets to be policy and not. And we work with a number of other organizations in coming up with those policy details. So I'll just start with just a little bit of what boards actually do. They are charged by statute to protect the public in their state and to make sure that the physicians and other healthcare professionals that they regulate are qualified to provide their services safely to the public in an independent manner. By doing this, they promulgate rules and regulations. They do educational outreach. They also are very active in physician wellness programs. And one of the important things that they do take complaints from the public, for peers and others, and then investigate those to make sure that that individuals are practicing in a safe manner. So, and through the licensing process, everyone gets an initial licensure in a state. And then those licenses are not just forever. They're, every state has a renewal process. And that gives the boards an opportunity to look at what their practice has been either over the year, most of them are a two-year cycle, to see if there's been any change they have in their practice. And to just to make sure that folks are getting the continuing education. As you know, in medicine, it's such a safety-sensitive profession, and the science changes all the time, that you have to stay current in order to take care of your patients. Basically, the framework is that individuals have to have a medical degree. In the United States and Canada, it's in accredited programs. And then we work with Intel to make sure that folks that have gone to international medical schools have attained this a level that they, since we're not necessarily familiar with the medical schools, that those folks are able to enter graduate medical education programs in the United States. Also then the postgraduate training, and yes, you're right, most every state has a requirement for postgraduate training. I will say that more than 40 states do have some programs to recognize some portion of medical residency outside of the United States. So this has been something that has been more one-offs than in just for everyone. And medical boards can consider those cases on an individual basis. So that is the basic process. And as far as international medical graduates, of course, we can't minimize the contribution that they do to our healthcare system. And the first influx of international medical graduates were really in the early 1900s. That continued to grow. And then in the 40s, hospitals and others recognized that we didn't have enough U.S. graduates to fill all of those internships and residency positions. And then after World War II, that number really began to grow. And now in the United States, we have over 1 million physicians. And it's about 23% larger physician population than in 2010. And interestingly, the same, it's 23% is from our census of the proportion of those physicians that are international medical graduates. So I don't know if you can see the slide, but it really breaks down where the countries that our international medical graduates come from. We have graduated in the last 2 years ago, graduated more than 2,300 medical schools. We have graduates from more than 2,300 medical schools around the world. And as you see, the largest number of physicians from other countries are from India. But the Caribbean medical schools are a close second. And they, this slide, kind of, you can see the percentages and the countries of the highest countries that they are coming from. This slide just really shows the growth in graduates from the Caribbean medical schools. And I think it should be noted that about 67% of those individuals are U.S. citizens. So this, since 2010, there's been a 126% increase in the number of graduates from those Caribbean schools. This just shows the Census Bureau divisions, just for context for my next slide. And so this shows really where the international medical graduates are located within those divisions. As you see, the most are in the Northeast, and then it goes down to the Mountain Division is the lowest. And talking about the legislation, as I mentioned earlier, between, there were many, there were states that already even had in statute. Some of them were just certain countries that they would accept from others. And so there were different models. In fact, more than 40 different models out there. If you're, and we've been trying to do a deep dive on that. Happy to share that with you. So, and now since this these bills are now there and being passed, and the state boards are really, for the most part, they're going to be who is going to be delegated to implement those and figure out the rules around that and what how to implement it and where are those points that there could be some concern around, or some, not necessarily concern so much as unknowns, maybe is a better way to put it. So with that, in light of that, we've had discussions, and this year we formed a commission with our partners at IntHealth and the Accreditation Council for Graduate Medical Education. That work has just begun, and they're getting together and they're representing, they have bring a large group of individuals together from different organizations to look at the current state and what kind of recommendations or help and guidance could be developed that could help states implement these bills. And I don't think anyone is opposed to looking at these alternate models or exploring them, but how we go about it in a safe manner to ensure that public protection is not compromised, and yet we are getting the talent into the country. So we expect this guidance to be issued sooner rather than later, because you're going to have to look at regulatory rulemaking and some of the, and also where we can bring some consistency around the country to how they're located, how they're implemented. So thank you.
Thank you. Lisa, does the American Medical Association or the American Osteopathic Association, do they have any position on these kind of reforms?
They are included in this group, in this commission. Yes, they are certainly invited participants to be at the table. So I think as far as formal positions, I don't know a formal position that they would have.
Okay. I want to ask Mac a question. So in my own experience working with IMGs in Phoenix, I noticed that your story is not so unique. I know a lot of physicians who are in specialties that's not what they were trained to do. In fact, there's a cardiologist who always impressed me when he was attending to my post-op critically ill patients with his kind of understanding of the issues I was dealing with. He would say things like, well, you're going to probably want to advance the drain, so why don't I hold off on making this change? And one day I said, how do you know so much about what I'm going to do? Because you're right. And, well, I used to be a surgeon in India, but I'm a cardiologist in the United States. So that's not an unusual story. How common is, do you, as an IMG, you see that with a lot of your fellow IMGs?
So, Jeff, I don't have any, you know, research or statistics that I can quote, but from my anecdotal experience that I have, I think I would say actually a majority of international medical graduates that come to the U.S. have to make compromises professionally, because, you know, there are so many. First of all, to get into a residency slot, you realize that when you're applying to a residency, you know that you're going to be ranked the lowest. You know, and irrespective of what experience you, one of my best friends was a ENT qualified surgeon from Pakistan who served in Saudi Arabia for 3 years, came here, and he had to actually, you know, could not, because of, he had some health issues and, you know, he could not take his USMLE and the residency, so now he's working as a nurse. And actually he's working as a nursing director. You know, which again is in the, because, you know, I always tell people that it takes a special breed, and nothing against surgeons, to be able to survive in ORs, right? Because I can't get close to an OR. That's just, and people who've lived in that environment, they love being there, right? And then, yeah. So this is a typical case of that. This was a very qualified ENT surgeon. He just had to go back, so he's working as a director of nursing, you know, but this happens a lot, and, you know, there are, when you and again, I'm not, you know, I think those physicians who come to the U.S. do profit financially, hugely, but that comes at a cost. The cost is that professionally, you have to make compromises. So a lot of physicians change their, you know, specialties that they trained in.
John, I noticed Cicero, I think, has two model bills that it's been promoting. Obviously, Tennessee and probably all the states, they're using it sort of as a general guideline, but they're not necessarily adopting it verbatim. But one of them, this one I think either just passed or is about to pass in my state of Arizona, limits IMG, in my state, the bill that they passed, you have to have an active license for at least 5 years in one of a list of first world countries, including Switzerland, the UK, Ireland, and then you have to work in a remote part of Arizona where the county has less than 1 million population for at least 4 years before you can get an unrestricted license. And I'm thinking, gee, if I was an orthopedic surgeon in Switzerland, I don't know that I'd want to work in, no offense on my fellow Arizonans, but I don't know if I want to work in Kingman or Holbrook or Winslow for 4 years before I could move to Phoenix and practice as an orthopedic surgeon there. I think I'll stay in Switzerland. So I wonder how effective such a bill is, but I know that's one of your models, so I wanted to comment on that.
Yeah, great question, Jeff. So when we started working on this issue, we looked at what other states had done, and there are a handful of states that have looked at specific countries that they want to have these relationships with. In Canada, if you're licensed in a handful of countries, the path is pretty clear and smooth for you to transition your license into Canada, and that's where that list came from. What we've found in working with legislators is that in most states, that's not been the preferred pathway. And I think that, you know, our preference, and when we sit down with legislators, is not to pick a list of countries, it's to be as broad as possible. There are obviously some states that would prefer particular countries be left out, maybe because of geopolitical reasons that state has, you know, that their community has with the training in a particular country. And so in Arizona, in particular, we have been privileged to work with Senator Schamp, who is the sponsor of that bill. I do think that your concerns are valid. I think that is a situation where the medical board and the medical association in the state really did fight to limit what was possible and what they would support. And so that's how we got to that bill. The original draft of that bill was not limited to a list of countries. It did not require 4 years in a rural area, but that was kind of the compromise of legislation. And one thing at Cicero, our business model is, you know, as a nonprofit, we work with legislators, we will come up with a model, but then we will sit down, and we've sat down with folks in governor's offices, folks in the legislature, folks in the state medical boards. We try to sit down and say, what makes sense in your state? And so different states want to do it in different ways. And so I am hopeful that if Arizona passes their bill, that I'm with you is not anywhere near as broad as what we would recommend a state put in place, that they will then have a chance to look at what the outcomes are in their state versus a state like Virginia that still has some rural requirements versus then a state like Florida that doesn't have any of those requirements. And so just see, and I think one of the things, and the Federation will be super helpful in helping us to do data collection, because one of the challenges that we're all going to have, and a question we get all the time, and I'm sure you will get these same questions from the medical boards, is what's the population look like of people who we want to come? You probably have the best guess on this panel of what that population of people who would be interested in coming to the United States and practicing, because all we can look at are some of these anecdotes around the country. But I think that you're right. That is a much more restricted version. I still applaud the legislature for working on it, and there are political realities on the ground in every state of you can only do certain things in a legislative session. But I do think that as I sit here right now, and I've said this in testimony in Arizona on that bill, I think that they are less likely to get the people who they would want. Those doctors are more likely to go to other states where they don't have as restrictive a requirement.
Lisa, do you know what the Arizona medical board's misgivings were about the original proposal?
You know, I'm sorry, I really have not talked to anyone from the Arizona board about these, about the bills. But I mean, and most of these bills really are not being driven by the boards. They're driven by the legislatures. And some of the boards have had input early on in trying to craft what would work and what makes sense. Others have not. And then so they're just trying to figure out, you know, how best to implement it. But I think the states where you see what they're trying to accomplish, what are the outcomes we're trying to accomplish for many of these states is to get some care in their rural areas. Mm-hmm. And so I understand the rationale for those bills and being crafted in that manner.
I wonder, in your experience working with lawmakers, is there any resistance, not from the medical boards, but from some lawmakers because of not liking the idea of foreign doctors coming over here?
It's amazing the different things that hold people up. There are members who have children who are in the medical profession, and they're concerned about the competitiveness. I mean, that one of the arguments that is made about licensing in general is that licensing is protectionist. That doesn't mean that all licensing is only protectionist. That's not what I'm saying. I'm an attorney. I joke around that after I pass the bar, I wish that, you know, they had basically said, in order to pass the bar, now you have to take it on one foot, you know, and you get half the time, right? It benefits me. Like, I'm not saying that that's the only reason licensing exists. Licensing exists for lots of things. But there are protectionist aspects of it. There are people who are concerned about people coming from other countries. Personally, at the point we have a quarter of our doctors already from other countries, that question already in my mind has been answered. If as a country we didn't want doctors who weren't Americans practicing, and that I'm putting in quotes because obviously once you've lived here a while, it doesn't matter where you're born, you're an American. But the situation you're going to have, if we wanted to have that conversation, that's a much older conversation. That conversation is water under the bridge. But there are people, right and left, who have raised concerns to me. It has been fascinating to me to see members of who would consider themselves very open-minded, very, you know, would point fingers at the other side of the aisle as being nativist, have said some of the most nativist things that I've ever heard in hearings, where people have called out people of certain races and been like, I don't want people of that country in my country practicing medicine. And so it's not even in one of those things where you can say, oh, this side of the aisle says it and the other side doesn't. I've heard it from both sides, and, you know, that's been an interesting thing. And, you know, it's been great for us because we've been able to work with legislators on both sides of the aisle who want to do this, but we've seen opposition from both sides of the aisle as well.
Okay, Mac, I think a lot of people may be getting the impression that all of the IMGs that want to come here to practice are, you know, that's their primary reason for coming here. But I think, and I've noticed this among a number of my colleagues, that in many cases, the IMG is the spouse of someone who's already coming here on an H-1B visa because they have a high-skilled job, unless they've been hired by, you know, some company in the tech industry. So now the spouse comes with the person hired by the tech industry, and he or she is a doctor and wants to be able to work. In your anecdotal experience, is that a common source of IMGs?
So, yeah, there is this. I know a lot of people personally whose spouses are physicians, and because they had to choose, you know, when you get generally most people who come here, professionals, come here at a stage of life when they have little children, and the children are going through school, they are requiring, you know, attention. And the other thing, I think you have to realize, a lot of these people who come here come from societies where they live in joint families, where you have uncles, aunts, grandparents who are helping you, you know, with your parenting. I always tell people that I think parenting here is much more difficult than parenting, let's say, in Pakistan, because in Pakistan there are other people, there are, you know, at least a half a dozen people who are helping me, you know, raise the children. Here, it's just you. You have to be your child's best friend. You have to be their parent. You have to be their, you know, buddy and everything. So now they have these young couples who come here. They have young children, and one of them is working and trying to establish him or herself here. The other, you know, the parent has to take a back seat to take care of the kids, and that doesn't have to. And I think that it is mostly the mothers who do that, because, you know, and so we you we lose a lot of female doctors. And I don't want to be gender biased, but I think there is a higher need for female doctors even today, practicing in Scottsdale, you know, which is probably one of the most affluent areas in the country. I still get requests from my patients who would prefer to see a female doctor, and it's hard to get them in. And now you have these, you know, I think there's a significant number of female spouses who are physicians who choose to stay at home instead of having to go through residency. And because going through residency is, you know, you literally have to, you know, go through hell and survive that to be able to get to the other end. Right. Mm-hmm. So there's a significant number of people there.
I'm going to be taking questions in a few minutes, but I got one more question I'd like to direct to Lisa. I'm just warning, I'm beta testing this idea. So I don't know. I'd like to get reactions. In fact, I'm going to ask all of you reaction afterwards. I'll start with Lisa. So as you know, right now, the ACGME has been granted monopoly status by all the states. In 2020, the American Osteopathic Association merged with the ACGME. So now whether you're a DO or an MD, you need to be graduated by an ACGME accredited med school. And many other countries have their own medical school accrediting organizations. Canada broke away from the ACGME. There's the UK has it, EU has it, and there's several countries. And the ACGME has sort of an international division called the ACGME-I, and they've been requested by teaching institutions and hospitals, medical schools rather, in several other countries to accredit them. To my knowledge, the last I saw from their website, I think they've accredited medical schools residency for graduate medical education program, in about a dozen countries, including Vietnam, Kenya, Haiti, Singapore. So why couldn't, just like the ACGME is invited to accredit residency programs in other countries, why couldn't state medical boards accept accreditation from residency programs from other countries as well, say, you know, accredited by the ACGME equivalent in the UK or in Canada or EU?
Well,
I'm just beta testing this.
I think that's the issues that people will be looking at. At this point, even through the Department of Education, you know, they look at countries for the purposes of loans. They look at countries that have accreditation systems in place for their medical schools and that are somewhat similar. There's nothing like that for residency programs, and so I think that's one of the questions is does the country have an accreditation system for residencies? I think there's going to be such diversity and complexity that these are some of the things that we really don't have enough information about yet, but that we will be, you know, trying to work with others, not only here but in the international community. There is an International Association of Medical Regulatory Authorities. I think this is going to be something that they will be discussing because this is not just the United States. Other countries are experiencing the same and trying to figure out how to do this right.
Because it would seem to me that, for example, it could kind of be an alternative to what Cicero is proposing. Is let's say a state licensing board recognizes a graduate medical education program from, you know, a menu of different. So you may have been in Mac Bull's situation. You went did your residency in the UK. You're practicing in Pakistan. Well, we recognize the UK medical board, so it's the same as having done residency in the ACGME. I'm just thinking that could be another way around the bottleneck. You got any thoughts about that, John?
I mean, I think that, you know, that will be a part of the conversation. I think that as the state medical boards are evaluating what's the best way to try to decide what is equivalent training, what does a residency look like, I think that one thing that I'm going to be interested to watch is how much interest there is in figuring out expanded pathways versus interest in trying to narrow them. And I think that will, in many states, be the determining factor. I think that you could very easily see someone say, well, we feel comfortable with the following EU countries, their graduate medical education, and then everyone go, but maybe not anything else. And that starts to get problematic because Dr. Max, the prime example, the majority of our doctors in the United States are not coming from the European Union. They're coming from the Caribbean. They're coming from Asia. And so if the conversation is, let's just have them be European docs and Australian docs, that doesn't really, like, if you're trying to figure out ways to attract people, those doctors are more likely, in my opinion, to come for temporary stints, right? You could see someone who's a European doctor who might say, hey, I'll come over for 6 years while my kids are in college in the United States and practice. The likelihood that they're going to move their family and spend the rest of their career here may be lower. On the flip side, a doctor who is in China, who is in the Caribbean, those doctors in Brazil, South America, they may have significantly more interest in coming to the United States.
Well, I'm actually looking at it even in a broader way. So, for example, you went to medical school in Pakistan, but you did your residency at the London College Hospital in the UK, and then you went back to Pakistan and practiced in there for 10 years. Well, the licensing board recognizes the London College Hospital, so it's good enough. Or, alternatively, just like graduate medical education programs in a dozen other countries have asked the ACGME to accredit them, maybe that'll open up residency programs because some community hospitals, for example, that would like to start a family practice residency program, but the ACGME accreditation requirements they find too difficult to meet, well, maybe they could seek accreditation from a different organization because you no longer have a monopoly. So you can seek accreditation from an accreditation organization in another advanced country, or another one will develop here.
I'm not opposed to there being different entities that are doing accreditation at the higher education level across the board. I think that competition is good in those ways. I understand standards need to be met, and I understand those things, but I do think that in higher ed, for example, the decision to allow people to go to whichever, instead of being stuck with your regional accreditor, allowing universities to go to all of the accreditors around the country for their accreditation is probably a net positive for higher education. And I do think it probably makes sense for there to be some other entities with, you know, put boundaries in place about what that has to look like, but it doesn't make sense to necessarily have a monopoly on those things.
Okay, I think I want to go to questions. So we'll take questions from the audience and from online. If you want to submit a question online, please, if possible, tell us who you are, but you don't have to. You can submit on our event webpage as well as YouTube, Facebook, and X, and use the hashtag Cato Health. And anybody in the audience wants to ask a question, we ask you that, we'll wait for the microphone to come around, and we ask you that you state your name and affiliation, please. So we have a person right here in the second row. The mic is coming around.
Thank you. Mike Zimmer, World Education Services. And this is more in the nature of a comment than a question. The data on the 23% of current licensees being IMGs is incredibly important. I think going forward, though, we have to drill down on our data a little bit. The vast majority of those IMGs probably did a U.S. or Canadian residency, and the alternative pathway we're talking about is an alternative to residency. So as boards start to collect data going forward, if they can collect data on previously licensed IMGs who either came in through an alternative pathway, came through exceptional circumstances, came through academic licensing, I think that would be very, very valuable.
I agree. I mean, I think what we don't have is any data yet, and looking at that. And those numbers are probably relatively small. And because most of these states, the majority of states have certain, you know, whether it be a faculty license, emeritus license, or, you know, various institutional licenses. They're not huge numbers, is my understanding. But I think that that's right, that there needs to be a lot of data collection, I think, to support any policy work, right? You want to be able to evaluate it.
I got a question online that I'll direct first to you, Lisa. I'm restructuring it a little bit so it flows better. But this person wants to know that no state licensing board requires that you be board certified in a specialty. Why does the Well, the FSMB doesn't insist on anything, actually, but why does, the question is, why does the FSMB insist on requiring applicants to have ABMS board certification in order to get a license to practice in the state? Well, I'll let you straighten that out.
There is no state board that requires specialty certification for a license. So that's not a requirement in any jurisdiction. It possibly you're talking about a compact or something.
And the FSMB has no requirements. It's the state licensing board.
We have no authority over our state boards, but it is not associated. The license to practice is a general undifferentiated practice.
Correct. Yeah. My state of Arizona requires you to do 1 year of postgraduate, complete all three steps of the USMLE and graduate from an accredited medical school, and then you go out into practice. In fact, that's what I did when I was in the first year of my 5-year surgical residency way back when, because that enabled me to get a license as a general practitioner. So I was moonlighting besides doing my residency to make some extra money to support my family, because in those days, they paid residents almost nothing. So I'm just trying to feel sorry for myself.
Jeff, if I may, sure. I think that question does raise a valid concern, and I think this is something that part of the conversation going forward is going to need to talk about, is a lot of the state licensing boards aren't requiring, but hospital privileges and other things are linked to whether or not you are board certified, which is different than the FSMB.
Yes.
Like, very clear, like, this is not Lisa licensure and her group, don't talk about that. That's not them. But I think it is important for us to recognize, especially as states are doing this, if we start receiving more than a small handful of doctors that are getting licensed, and you know, trends are indicating that that's likely to happen as more and more states, Mike has phone calls with states around the country. Part of the reason you're convening is not because, oh, we have 8 states doing this, it's this conversation is happening around the country. As we're having that conversation, what do we do to allow doctors who are good, who we agree are good, but don't have a U.S. residency, get board certified? Because most of the specialty boards do require a U.S. residency. And so finding ways to make sure that those docs, maybe they have to practice for a period of time, what that looks like, we can have lots of discussions on, but that's going to be a piece of the future puzzle.
I think it's important for those who don't know this that there's not a monopoly on specialty boards. Obviously, the biggest one is the American Board of Medical Specialists. I think about 70% of people who are specialty board certified are ABMS board certified. But there are 3 other certification entities that also certify in specialties. So in that case, there are options. Richard Payerchin of Medical Economics has this question. There was no mention about IMGs being trained in primary care. Are there any figures or percentages on IMGs in primary care specialties such as family medicine, internal medicine, pediatrics, and OBGYN? Does anyone have any information on that?
I think what we do know is that IMGs are more likely, like current IMGs who go through the current process, so they go through residency in the United States, they are more likely than kids who graduate from American medical schools to work in primary care and to work in underserved areas. Now, that doesn't mean that they're all doing it. Right? That doesn't mean that every single doctor who's trained in the United States doesn't become primary care, but they are more likely. I think that this goes to Lisa's point about the need for data, because one of the things we don't have great data on is not only what types of specialties people wind up doing, because the state licensing boards, again, they're licensing, to Lisa's point, they're licensing you generally. They're saying you are a doctor in the state of Texas. You are a doctor in the state of California. They don't say you are an orthopedist in the state of, you know, Louisiana. And so those data are harder to gather because you're relying on, and FSMB does a great survey, but your census only can get as good a data as the boards themselves have.
Right.
So you have anything to add to that, Lisa?
So, no, I think it's exactly right. I mean, you know, what we have and how the specialties, if they collect that data and how they break it down, I just think it's another example. We need some better data collection.
Although I would, unfortunately, fewer and fewer medical students are pursuing careers in primary care because among the different specialties, they are the lowest paying. Mm-hmm. And if you're coming from another country, you'd be much more willing to take a lower paying profession in order to be able to practice as a physician in this country. So that would, I would just think that you will see a number, sort of in similar stories to Mac's story, which is a position open up in primary care, I don't want to sit around and do, you know, be an Uber driver. I'll take it. And so that's, I think, just in terms of what's likely to happen. Anonymous said, has a question for Dr. Halapota. I'm wondering if Dr. Halapota had done a residency in Pakistan before moving to the U.S., or whether his U.S. residency was the first postgraduate training he had.
So, yeah, so when I graduated, you know, in the British system, once you graduate, you have to do a year of what is called a house job, like which is internship here. And generally, they divide it in two parts, you know. So, and that, what specialties you get into is based on how you rank in your graduating class. And the preferred are internal medicine and surgery. So I did 6 months of internal medicine, 6 months of surgery. Then, as I said, my father wanted me to be a surgeon, so he hooked me up with his buddy, who was the chief of pediatric surgery. And I worked in pediatric surgery, and it so happens that 3 months into it, the professor called me one day and said, "Makpul, this is not your cup of tea." I know this. And I said, "Yes, I completely agree with you." So he was kind enough to call my father and say, "Why are you putting him through this?" And that's when I ended up in physical medicine and rehab. And I trained there. And,
so that was a residency program in physical medicine?
It was not a classic, because this was such a new specialty then. I don't know if you have time. Because this was in the 80s, and you know, this is the time. I don't want to get too political about it, but just to give you a background, this was the time when the Soviet Union had invaded Afghanistan. And Afghanis were our allies then. They were called Mujahideen, who were fighting the Afghani, you know, the communists of Soviet Union. So the supporters of the Afghan Mujahideen had set up this shop in Jinnah Postgraduate Medical Center, which was the premier postgraduate medical center in Pakistan, in Karachi. And they had set up this rehab, department, where our main focus was to, we would get patients from Afghanistan who would, you know, because of the bombings, they would lose their arm or their leg. Our job was to fit them so that they could go back and fight the Soviet Unions. So this was, and our job, as you know, was my job was to train. You know, that was on-site kind of a training on the job. Because as you know, Jeff, as physician, maybe it's probably true for all other specialties, that as physicians, we get our knowledge from the books, but the clinical acumen, nobody can teach you that. Now, number one, that has to come within you, plus it comes from your mentors, right? So you acquire a lot of clinical skills and your acumen while there, and that is how it was. And that's why, that was my main focus of coming here and actually getting certified in physical medicine and rehab, because this is in the early 90s, such a new specialty, especially in Pakistan. That was my, whole idea. So that's what I alluded to earlier, is that, you do about 3 or 4 years of on-job, acquiring these clinical skills, and then you give that up completely and do something totally different. So, but there are a lot of people who did, who I know, my friends, who did actually train and were going to take the exams there, and then they came here, and then they went through. So that's what I did also. I did 4 years of kind of on-job training, and then I went back and went through the residency again.
For those who might be unfamiliar with the medical world, a lot of the specialties that we assume to be just regular specialties these days, I'm familiar also where some of them were just being formed. For example, the specialty in family medicine most primary care doctors were just general practitioners. And it wasn't until the early 70s that family medicine became a specialty, and the American Board of Family Medicine was formed. Same thing with emergency medicine. I was moonlighting in an emergency room because in the late 70s, early 80s, most of the doctors who were working in emergency rooms actually were, they could have been in any of the medical specialties, but they were providing services in the emergency room. And the specialty of emergency medicine, which is a real specialty now with formal residency programs, was just getting kind of off the ground in the late 70s, early 80s. So it's the same thing with physiatry, physical medicine and rehabilitation. Nowadays, of course, it's a pretty sophisticated specialty.
Good question.
We have a question in the audience. Did you see someone? Oh, okay. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Matthew Schick with Intelf. As you mentioned, we host the Education Commission on Foreign Medical Graduates, the certification for all IMGs that are entering the U.S., among a number of other services and support for IMGs. Jonathan, I just wanted to thank you and Cicero really for jump-starting this conversation with the model legislation that you put out. And I look forward to working with you on the Advisory Commission for alternative licensing models. That group has taken a little bit of a broader approach to how we operationalize this idea, looking not just at sort of legislation, but also the medical competencies, the assessment, what training would be needed for the supervisors as in that first year of temporary license, whether to consider mid-career physicians who might have exceptional ability in their field versus newer physicians, for instance, but also the resources and professional discretion that might be necessary for the boards as they implement this. As you mentioned, the immigration considerations and visa changes that might be needed at the federal level. And perhaps the biggest barrier or challenge is some of the private partners that are going to be called upon to look at comparability decisions, for instance, Dr. Singer. So my question ultimately is what advice you would give to states, both who are yet to pass legislation or introduce legislation, but also to those that might have introduced, like in Tennessee and passed in Tennessee, but are now going back and looking at trying to make some technical amendments or changes or consult more with their boards to make sure that this is going to run smoothly and what timeline that might entail.
Yeah, no, great question. And I think that now that the conversation is happening in a different way, I think part of the reason that legislatures were driving the conversation maybe a year ago, 2 years ago, was that a lot of the early conversations with medical societies and medical boards were pretty antagonistic. The feedback I've gotten from a lot of legislatures was they went, had conversations, were told, we're not doing this, not happening. And the legislators were going out to their constituents, and their constituents were like, I can't get an OB. Iowa, for example, they have, you know, the majority of their states have zero OBs in their county, or the majority of their counties have zero OBs. And so the legislators were kind of like, we don't really care if our medical society says we have enough, because we're hearing from our people who say we don't. I'm not saying that that's universally true, but I think that's part of what drove it. I do think that now the concept that everyone will come to the table, Idaho, Wisconsin, for example, the state medical boards have been great partners in having these conversations. The state medical board in Idaho, for example, actually said, hey, there's this category of people who won't have 5 years of practice for the following reasons, and we want to figure out ways to come up with equivalencies. So I am not here to say state medical boards are the enemy. I think that now that these conversations are happening, I think we're going to be in a really good place. I'd say there are three things that we should focus on. First is, what are the, you know, are there specialties or are there particular employers who we should be encouraging to do this and tell them that it's okay to do so, right? I think that there are some hospitals, there's some rurals that need to be the ones who really will lead on this. So in Tennessee, you obviously have HCA. And so it was easy to pass the bill as it was written because and limited to the particular kinds of training facilities because of some of the really large entities in that state. And so encouraging some of the big providers. The second thing, and this is a good, great opportunity for partnership between the states and the medical boards and the medical societies, is making sure that state Medicaid funding is allowed to be paid to these doctors. So if the medical board is going to license the person, we're not going to have a conversation of, hey, unfortunately, you went to the wrong doctor, and therefore state Medicaid isn't going to pay that doctor. We need to make sure that that is taken care of. And then the third thing, I think, is helping teach everyone in the room how many IMGs we already have. Because I think one of the interesting things when you have these conversations, you know, whether it's from a nativist perspective or a fear, whatever the reason that a person may be opposed to some of this, I think sometimes it's just a lack of knowledge of, did you realize that there's a 1 in 4 chance that when you pick up the phone and ask for an appointment, the doctor who you're going to go see, no matter what she or he looks like, didn't go to med school in the United States. And I think that if people realize that, then the fear of, oh, are they going to be well enough trained to treat me? They're not going to be able to get insurance. They're not going to be, there's lots of other things, and the medical boards will play their role as well. And I think that, but to me, those are really three things that I'm excited to work with the commission and really try to address those issues as we move forward.
You'd like to say anything, Lisa, to that? Or?
No, I agree. I mean, I think that we have to look at those and help those states make those tweaks. And as I said, you can't minimize the contribution that international medical graduates, because we've gotten nearly a quarter of of them in the country providing care. And I do think I would add on to that, I think it is important to look at these, at what is the appropriate sponsorship and the appropriate proctoring or supervision, because that and having to define that, because there are a lot of issues. Our healthcare system is really unique in the world. And I think dealing with all that, I mean, we keep hearing things all the time about how difficult it is for physicians and others having just to deal with the payer systems and the various, and so I think learning the systems is a big hurdle. And so that, and figuring those things out, I think is gonna be really key to have to, if this works.
And we have a question in the front row.
I'm Mark Lerner. Not really a question, but maybe a comment. I mean, I'm a radiology administrator, and the healthcare system, we really need these international medical graduates to be able to practice here, because the U.S. healthcare system is a total mess. I mean, people cannot get in. You can't get an appointment. You can't even reach someone to get an appointment. And recently, I've been traveling as part of my job. I've worked in Napa. I've worked in Geneva, New York, and there's such a severe physician shortage. It's just incredible. You know, the other side of this, we don't want these doctors really to have to go to a residency, because I've been acquainted with these residency interviews, and I could easily see these doctors being blocked from being allowed to be accepted into residency programs. So, I really think it's very important.
Do you have a question or just a comment? You want to say something?
Well, I think there's a couple of, I just going back to, I keep giving my example. So in this country, I've practiced in, Brooklyn, New York, in a very inner city area. I've practiced in Berea, Kentucky, that's as rural as it can get. And I've been in practice in Scottsdale, which is as suburban as it can get. So I think the trust that the patients have in their physicians has nothing to do with where they graduated from. I've had patients, that were seeing very highly qualified people who graduated from very high known ranking schools in America. But when you're sitting in front of a human being, all they want to do is see in your eyes and see some compassion. That's all they care about. And they need to trust that you will treat them as a family member, So I don't think the problem is with the patients and the providers. I know that you can't just open the floodgates, and there has to be some regulation. But I just going back to it, I think we have to divide the basic skills. You can judge the basic skills of a physician based on exams. It is very difficult to judge the competency of the clinical acumen they have based on any exams. That has to come from somebody, another person who's supervising them, and can say, okay, I've worked with this physician, I'm an oncologist, he may have been trained in Timbuktu, but I think his skills, clinical skills, are good enough, and think that's where the barrier is. So I think that there's some way to find that, that'll help the patients in this country.
I agree with that. We doctors put all our diplomas on the wall for our patients to see. Most of them, they just want to make sure we graduated one of those schools. They don't really care which one it is. Unlike law school, that sometimes can make a difference regarding which firm you can get a position with, but not in medicine. This will be our last question. Then we're going to, for those, I don't know about people in the audience, but I'm getting hungry. And as soon as we adjourn, there'll be a luncheon upstairs, and I welcome all of you to join us. Carlos L. Has this question online. IMGs represent an impactful population of the workforce in clinical research and trials in both industry and academia. Would endorsing limited/supervised clinical research medical licenses for academic clinical research be a realistic possibility, considering the benefits to diversity and equity? Do you have anything, anyone you want to say to that?
I mean, that's one area. I think if Jonathan Wolfson is picking, if the Cicero Institute is picking, I think if most state legislators are picking where you want to address the physician shortage, it's probably not in academic research. That's not to say that there aren't people who are doing great academic research, but at the point you're not touching a patient, that becomes a conversation that, you know, the NIH grant requirements and, you know, whatever university is deciding whether or not they bring them in. So I'm not opposed to international doctors being part of the research process. They should, because humans need healthcare and need this research all over the world. But if I'm picking where to put my energy, it's going to be toward people who are actually touching the patients, because to your point, the shortages, regardless of whether the raw numbers of doctors are higher today than they've ever been, as we face these cliffs, as we look at the number of hours, and those are data questions that we're all interested in looking at, I think the doctor shortage and the ability to access care is becoming harder and harder in this country. And that's the place that I prefer to put my resources.
Lisa, I read somewhere that sometimes a clinical research position could be a way to get a license as an IMG without having to go through residency. Do you know anything about that?
No, but as I mentioned, there have been individual ways and different and limited licenses. So I know it could be like an institutional license where they were limited to practicing within whatever academic or area, but I don't have any information on how often that occurs.
Okay, well, unless there are any other questions, we do have one more. Okay, in row three here, so can somebody come around with a microphone?
Hi, my name is Jacob Ross. I'm a current medical student and health policy intern at Paragon Health Institute over in Arlington. My question was about the visas. So most IMGs, my understanding is get J-1 visas, but that carries with it a requirement to go back to your country for 2 years before you can practice. Mm-hmm. And there's a limit. I think each state can give like 30 waivers. And there's other ways to get waivers. So my question is, does anybody have any data or knowledge about how often are people actually going back to their countries to practice for 2 years before coming to the US, or are most IMGs just going home and staying home?
So I'm not sure on the specific data number of like how many folks are getting, obviously the Conrad 30 program is very limited. There's 30 per state. So that's, and there are a lot more IMGs doing graduate education here in the United States. I think that one thing, and I'll just say this and then I'll stop, there is an immigration conversation that is probably a part of this. And I think as you get more states that are having these licensing pathways, there probably is a conversation that needs to be had about what are the types of visas individuals should be allowed to use if they're going to practice. There's a potential that you could say we're going to uncap H-1Bs for folks who are doing these programs. I mean, there are different paths you could take.
Yeah, independent of state licensing board requirements, there's a separate U.S. immigration policy. So there are two pieces to this. Actually, a couple of years ago, we had an online event on this subject that Dr. Halapota participated in as well. And one of our immigration policy experts, Alex Narasta, was a participant. He filled us in on a lot of this. I'm not an expert on that, but I know you can't. There are two pieces to the puzzle. What we're talking about here is licensing board reform, which you don't have to wait for immigration policy reform to get the licensing board reform into place. But you definitely need both of these. It's a real shame that you can come here to train, do a residency in the United States, and then have to go back to your native country after you developed all these skills in this country. But that's the way, unfortunately, it is.
There was a question in the back.
Wait, is a question in the back? Oh, we got more questions. Okay. We also have in the back afterwards.
Most of the IMGs that have been licensed so far in states like Washington and New York, who have long-standing limited licenses without pathways, those individuals are legally present in the country already under other immigrant statuses. They came as refugees, they're here as asylees, they came a long time ago with their family as immigrants. So while you're right, this conversation does have to be linked to an overall immigration conversation. The population that could access these pathways is already here.
And there was somebody in the back with a question?
Hi, yeah, Kevin Dyeratna, Chief Statistician at Heritage. Firstly, I wanted to make a comment about data regarding foreign medical graduates. Charting outcomes in the MATCH produced by the NRMP has data by specialty regarding IMGs and AMGs, so that can shed some light on that question. But my broader question was about the premise of the argument here regarding alternatives to ACGME accreditation for training. I think if you asked the ACGME the questions that we are asking amongst ourselves, they're going to come back to you and they're going to say, these other countries don't have the level of quality in terms of the training that we provide here, therefore we shouldn't accept it. How would we address this type of question that is almost surely going to come up?
Anybody want to take that?
I think that ACGME is certainly at the table on this. I don't believe that that's going to be the reaction you're going to hear.
I also think that there are differences in training around the world, but I think what's also fascinating in the United States, there's also a lot of variation. An ER residency in the Bronx looks very different than an ER residency in rural Nebraska. Mm-hmm. And yet, if you have an ER residency in New York and you want to go practice in rural Nebraska, we let you do it, and vice versa. And so I think that as I have talked to people, the only thing that they don't learn, for sure don't learn in foreign countries' residencies, is how to deal with our payment system. True. But also, and I'll ask you, Dr. Matt, I don't think that most American doctors are spending the majority of their time doing it. They have staff who are doing those things. And so if you're working in a hospital, not that the doctors don't have to interact with it, but if the barrier to their ability to practice really comes down to their ability to figure out how to get Anthem to approve something, we can figure out how to train them to do that in a lot less than a 3+ year residency program.
Well, just to add to that, Jonathan, I don't think they teach that in the American medical schools also. that is true. I mean, because, as a resident, even as a fellow, you know, the business, they actually insulate you from that. Because the idea is that when you're making your clinical decisions, it should not be influenced by the financial risk, constraints of your care, because otherwise you could be providing different care to your patients. And even today, I've been in private practice. I'm a medical director of our local, office. And when patients ask me that, because oncology, even in Scottsdale, there are a lot of patients who cannot afford their care because of the co-pays and all that. And when they ask me that, I will tell them that I do not want to get into the finances. We have a whole, section that gets, foundations, that gets patients with their copay help, because that is the most complex part of the American healthcare system. It's not like Canada. It's not like the NHS in UK, where you just, you have a limited pharmacy and you work with that. The expectations are high, and you're trying to provide the best possible care, the latest care that you can. But there are so many, I would need a PhD to understand how many, sub plans United Healthcare has. It is impossible to keep track of it. So yes, that is true. That is something that you, and a lot of physicians never acquire, the financial part of that, the payer system. It's impossible to do that.
I would just add, and we're running out of time now, so I just add that it's hard for me to believe that the accreditation programs in a lot of advanced countries may have slightly different accreditation criteria, but I don't think that they would be tolerating poor doctors in places like the UK or the EU or places like that.
Can I add to that, Jeff? Sorry. Sure. So, you know, so the going back to that question, so we do accept physicians who graduate from foreign medical schools. So we're saying that, again, this goes back to that. We're saying that, okay, we think their basic training is the same. The question is, do they have the clinical skills? And to say that, have they acquired the same level of clinical skills overseas that they would have here? And the best way to judge that is to have them work with somebody who's LED licensed, instead of making them go back and go through the whole residency program. So the clinical acumen or the clinical skills are best judged by somebody, a mentor that you assign them with, where they work for, you know, without having to go back to do the residency, and, you know, so create an alternate way to get into the system.
I agree. We could keep going, but our time is up.
Yes, sir.
And I'd like to thank everybody for attending. If some of you arrived late or live stream, came on to the live stream a little late, missed it, this is has been recorded and will be archived and in a very short while, you could access this event on the Cato website, cato.org, and replay it and see what you missed. Thank you, everybody, for coming, and please join us for luncheon upstairs.